We are going to convene the subcommittee today to discuss the FY25 budget request for the Middle East and North Africa. Thank you to our witnesses for being here. We're going to start with some opening statements from myself and the ranking member, and then we'll get to statements from witnesses and questions. From the unconscionable terrorist attacks of October 7th to increasing threats to traffic in the Red Sea to the spiraling humanitarian disaster inside Gaza to rising tensions on the Israel-Lebanon border to the unforeseen transition of power in Iran, the Middle East has been in an unusual amount of tumult and violence since the subcommittee last met to review the State Department's regional budget. Amidst this chaos, I have one thought that dominates all others. Thank goodness at this moment that we have Joe Biden's steady hand on the wheel. Since October 7th, President Biden and his team, including our witnesses, in particular Secretary Leaf, have been tirelessly working the phones and crisscrossing the region to secure a comprehensive deal that ends the conflict in Gaza and releases the hostages. And let me underscore how critical it is that this conflict come to a close. I want Hamas's ability to launch another terrorist attack destroyed. I want our sacred ally Israel to live without the threat of violence or attack. And it's important to note that this conflict could end tomorrow if Hamas surrenders. But they won't, because they don't give a damn about the Palestinian people. But I do not understand how Israel's current military strategy in Gaza, or their current lack of a strategy for what to do once the military campaign ends, effectuates either of those goals. Right now, to me, it appears that Israel's Gaza policy is guaranteeing that the threats to Israel continue, not that they are eliminated. Leveling Gaza to the ground and unnecessarily killing thousands of innocent civilians in the process, it has a short-term moral cost, but it has a long-term strategic cost. The long-term strategic cost is that the carnage can become a boon to terrorist recruiting. That's what we saw in the aftermath of our invasions to Iraq and Afghanistan, and I don't understand why we are not learning those lessons. But just as important as bringing the violence to an end is planning for the day after, because without a plan for how to rebuild and secure Gaza under viable new political leadership, terrorist groups like Hamas are just going to fill the vacuum, feeding on the despair of the Palestinian people and posing a continued threat to Israel. It's no secret that right now there is not a viable plan for the day after in Gaza. I'm glad that the administration is prioritizing planning with regional partners and like-minded allies in the EU and the G7. I'd like to hear more about that today. Part of this day after plan has to include the creation of an independent Palestinian state, not just vague promises of a pathway to a state that never really come to fruition, but a concrete, irreversible timeline that culminates in statehood for the Palestinian people. Connected to a Palestinian state are recent discussions between Israel and Saudi Arabia to normalize relations. Normalized relations would be a very good thing. Reports suggest, though, that the price the Saudis are seeking for such an agreement is a NATO-like security guarantee from the United States, as well as control over the cycle of nuclear enrichment. That is an extraordinarily high price to command, and I am skeptical that such commitments would ultimately benefit the United States. We only give those commitments to our most trusted allies. And over again, most recently, just last week, when the Saudis refused to sign the Ukraine peace statement, we watch as Saudi Arabia plays us off against our adversaries. Pulling back to look at the region more broadly, there are other key questions this committee needs to ask today about how we allocate funding. For instance, does it make sense to habitually renew Egypt's military aid package of $1.3 billion, the exact same amount we have provided every year to Egypt since 1987. Does it make sense to provide just $6.5 million to civil society in Tunisia when those organizations are striving to protect human rights and fundamental freedoms in an increasingly forbidding environment? What crisis will we create in Jordan or Syria or Lebanon if we go another year without U.S. funding to UNRWA? Now, of course, our assistance dollars can have real impact, and there's no shortage of success stories that we should talk about as well. Support to our Arab partners and to Israel's Iron Dome system were critical in repelling Iran's unprecedented missile and drone attack on April 13th. In Lebanon, our support for the Lebanese armed forces has been instrumental in maintaining stability as political and economic elites push that country to the brink of collapse. And while there is always room to do more, our humanitarian aid has saved tens of thousands of lives in Gaza, Syria, and Yemen over the last decade. So we convene the subcommittee to review the State Department and USAID's budget in the region at a critical moment, and I look forward to our discussion today. With that, I'll turn it over to the ranking member.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last week's nominations hearing was a good opportunity to look at some of the challenges in the Middle East and North Africa. I'm very much looking forward to going deeper into these issues today with our witnesses who lead state and USAID's current policies and realities of what is perhaps the hottest of spots in a world full of them. And I hope that this deeper examination, in it, we can have a frank discussion about what is working and what is not working. The reality is that a nearly nuclear Iran is as bellicose as ever. Russia and China are ascendant in the region. In Europe, there are growing voices urging disengagement. Maritime security challenges in the Red Sea are constraining global commerce. Nascent alliances of our partners are at risk of crumbling, while those of our adversaries are being strengthened. Humanitarian assistance principles of neutrality and access are at their lowest post-World War II levels. Terrorist organizations are on the rebound, and smuggling of drugs, arms, and people is rampant, among other challenges. That's the bad news. Fortunately, there's some good news as well, and perhaps even more opportunity. Gulf countries have been eager to normalize relations with each other and Israel. Energy diplomacy, managed properly, is a generational opportunity to drive out Russian influence. Iraq is on stronger footing. And the recent potent and impotent displays of Israeli and Iranian, respectively, missile and anti-missile capabilities are among those positives. State and USAID's joint regional strategy for the MENA region is now 2 years old. A lot has happened in that time, and we don't need to dwell on how goals like enhanced prospects for a viable two-state solution for Israel-Palestine look in hindsight. But we do want to hear how this budget request reflects an updated view of that strategy's viability. I'd also like to get the administration's take on the relative priority areas in the region in terms of stability, countering violent extremism, supporting civil society, bolstering democracy, economic growth, etc. Obviously, the preferred answer is always all of the above, everywhere. We hear that a lot, but that's an aspiration, not a strategy. To the extent you can provide some specifics today, we're eager to hear them. We'll have specific questions for each of you, and I look forward to turning to that in a moment. Mr. Chairman.
It's now my pleasure to introduce Barbara Leaf, Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs. Assistant Secretary Leaf, well known to this committee, previously served as U.S. Ambassador to the UAE and Senior Director for the Middle East and North Africa at the National Security Council. Also joining us today is Ms. Jean Pryor, Deputy Assistant Administrator of the Bureau for the Middle East at USAID. Ms. Pryor previously served as Director for the Office of Afghanistan Affairs and Deputy Director for the Office of Iraq Reconstruction. I will hand the floor to both of you for 5 minutes of opening comments, and then we'll engage in discussion. Ambassador Leaf.
Thank you, Chairman Murphy, Ranking Member Young, members of the subcommittee. Thank you for inviting me to testify on the President's FY 2025 budget request for the Middle East and North Africa, a region that remains of vital importance to U.S. interests. While the Israel-Hamas conflict and escalation by Iran and its proxies complicate our work substantially, the administration is fully committed to leading the collective action necessary for a secure and stable region responsive to the needs of its people. Diplomacy is the best means to address the issues at hand, and your support will undergird our vigorous diplomatic engagements to advance U.S. interests and contest strategic competitors seeking to exploit post-October 7th instability. On May 31st, President Biden presented a comprehensive ceasefire and hostage deal accepted by Israel that can end the conflict in Gaza. This deal would bring all the hostages home, ensure Israel's security, lead to a complete ceasefire, facilitate a surge of humanitarian assistance into Gaza, begin the refurbishment of essential services, and set the stage for the long-term recovery of Gaza. I just returned from a trip to the region with Secretary Blinken, where we announced new humanitarian assistance in response to the conflict and pressed key partners to do what they can to get Hamas to accept the deal. We are currently reviewing Hamas's response. We're pursuing an end to the conflict that must be built on conditions of enduring security for both Israelis and Palestinians. Our FY 2025 request includes crucial life-saving aid for Palestinians in Gaza, as well as for millions of refugees and internally displaced persons in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Yemen. Our unrivaled network of partnerships, including those forged through the Abraham Accords, bolsters integrated defense and deterrence to counter malign actors. Israel, with the help of the U.S. and our allies, was able to defend itself from Iran's unprecedented missile and drone attack in April. To hold Iran accountable, we engaged with EU partners to secure expansion of sanctions authorities and worked jointly with the G7 and others to impose sanctions. Our regional partners play a critical role ensuring regional stability and security. Egypt remains a vital partner for addressing the Israel-Hamas conflict and preventing regional spillover. It serves as a key staging ground and entry point for humanitarian aid and as a throughput for those evacuating Gaza. Qatar is indispensable to our efforts to secure the release of hostages. Jordan, too, has played a leading role in promoting peace and security in the region, and that cooperation remains critical to our regional security priorities. In 2022, we signed the 7-year MOU on assistance. Jordan is making good progress towards its benchmarks, and we will be with them every step of the way to implement them. We're concerned with the escalating hostilities along the Blue Line in Lebanon. Diplomacy is the only path for Lebanese and Israeli citizens on both sides of the Blue Line to return home, and it is the way that we can support the Lebanese Armed Forces in its role of providing security there. We were grateful for the role the LAF played in protecting our embassy perimeter in Beirut during violent protests last October and in responding most recently to a terrorist attack on our embassy. Our requests also calibrate support for the Tunisian people to address their needs in, as you said, Senator Murphy, an increasingly forbidding environment. Targeted U.S. investments in the Tunisian Armed Forces have promoted professionalism and accountability there and counter strategic competitors attempting to gain influence by exploiting Tunisia's security challenges. Your support for the department's plan to establish an interim diplomatic facility in Libya allows us to scale up our diplomacy amid an intensification of Russia's destabilizing influence. Libya's funding under the Global Fragility Act and our $19.25 million in bilateral assistance request supports our work to move Libya to an eventual transition to a democratic, stable, and unified state. We seek a durable resolution to the conflict in Yemen through an inclusive peace process under UN auspices. Houthi attacks in the Red Sea threaten the regional and global economy and undermine prospects for that peace. The $41.6 million Yemen request advances our priorities of lasting peace in Yemen and economic security for the Yemeni people. Our commitment to greater regional stability includes the enduring defeat of ISIS, which continues to pose a significant threat. With funds raised through the coalition and the continued support of Congress, we can improve security and reduce the populations in Al-Hol and Rojava camps. Our $118.5 million request in ESF for Syria supports vulnerable populations who might be vulnerable to ISIS recruitment and works against ISIS's ability to reconstitute and threaten the U.S. Our goal is a stable and sovereign Iraq, integrated regionally and with the global within the global economic system. Our work with Iraq to diversify and grow its economy helps the Sudani government deliver better opportunities for the Iraqi people. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the President's FY 2025 budget request, and I want to close by thanking the subcommittee for your continued support for our efforts in the region.
Thank you very much. Ms. Pryor.
Chairman Murphy, Ranking Member Young, and distinguished members of the subcommittee, thank you for inviting me to testify today at this incredibly difficult time in our region. We all know that the Middle East and North Africa are at a critical inflection point. Hamas's abhorrent attack on Israel and the ongoing conflict in Gaza have taken center stage across the globe. The challenges of the moment offer an opportunity in which the relatively modest amounts in our fiscal year 2025 request might play an outsized role in shaping a peaceful and prosperous future for the region. While we remain focused on the immediate response, we must also examine the entire scope of the region's challenges in order to envision a path forward. Water and food insecurity, high numbers of displaced persons from conflicts and national disasters, corruption, and economic mismanagement already strained the region's resources prior to October 7th. The region's fragile economies have been further set behind by the ongoing violence. Palestinian gross domestic product in 2023 declined by $1 billion compared with 2022, all of that in the fourth quarter. And earlier this year, the International Monetary Fund lowered its growth forecast for the region to 2%, significantly below the 5.6% growth rate seen in 2022. Our fiscal year 2025 request proposes critical investments to address the region's needs. In response to the conflict, we have requested an increase of $10.3 million to mitigate post-conflict needs in Gaza and the West Bank, and $5 million for Lebanon. We've also requested an $11 million increase in funding to support Morocco's recovery from last year's earthquake, and an additional $22 million to reintegrate returnees from Al Hol into their communities. We will use these increases and our other requested investments to build on our previous accomplishments. More recently, USAID supported the departure of 66 families from Al Hol camp to Deir Ezzor Governorate, where we are supporting them and their communities with legal assistance, transitional shelter, psychosocial support, and job opportunities. And a few weeks ago in Morocco, Administrator Samantha Power announced our partnership with the government of Morocco and an NGO to give direct cash grants to 180 cooperatives whose livelihoods were compromised by the earthquake. Our peace-building work deserves particular attention given the growing divisions in the region. Although tensions remain high, we continue to see signs of hope in the dedicated peace-builders in the region. Our partners through the Nita M. Lowy Middle East Partnership for Peace Act remain committed to their work, and our Middle East Regional Cooperation Program has likewise seen positive signals for continued cross-border collaboration from its participants. Proposals for collaboration between Palestinian and Israeli researchers remain among the top proposed Merck partnerships. Our FY25 request continues funding for these critical activities to continue the work of building enduring peaceful ties between Israel and its neighbors. Despite the numerous regional challenges, space remains to influence the trajectory of the region. The region's young population will play a critical role in shaping their future. We must invest in helping these young people develop a Middle East and North Africa region that is integrated into the global economy. With the funds requested, we will not only empower the people of the Middle East and North Africa to forge a more promising and prosperous future, but also ensure security for America and its allies. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both, for your testimony. We will now undergo a round of five-minute questions. Ambassador Leaf, let me first talk to you about day-after planning in Gaza. The FY25 request largely maintains recent funding levels for the West Bank and Gaza, despite the fact that we know we have a huge bill ahead of us. But we can't spend money effectively in Gaza if we don't have a governance structure that keeps Israel safe and understands political realities on the ground in Gaza. My understanding is that Prime Minister Netanyahu has essentially refused to start post-war planning in Gaza, not because he doesn't believe it is important to do so, but because he has pressure from his far-right coalition partners who want to reoccupy Gaza with Jewish settlements. So can you just talk for a moment about the status of planning for what the governance structure looks like once this conflict comes to a close, because we are keeping our fingers crossed that with or without an agreement, we are, you know, potentially weeks, maybe a month or two away from the formal military operations coming to a close. And it is just extraordinary that we have no viable plan from the Israeli government as to what comes next.
Senator, this question of what comes next, what comes after this conflict is one that we have discussed extensively with our Arab partners, with the Palestinians, with the Israeli government over the course of the last 4 or 5 months. And you're right, there is still insufficient planning, to say the least, on the part of the Israeli government. I would say, however, that that has not kept us from doing the work on our side and consulting extensively, and also drawing up some concepts that, as Secretary Blinken said last week, we will be prepared to share with partners here shortly. I just got back on Thursday from the trip that the Secretary took to Cairo, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Amman, and Doha, and I will probably leave again this weekend to continue those discussions and to drill in deeper. But suffice to say, there are some essential points of agreement, notwithstanding, and that is that everyone is joined by the resolve to see Hamas removed from a governance role, and a governance role in particular at the point of a gun. Now, how we get there is going to be exceptionally difficult, and in no small part because of the conditions that prevail now in Gaza. But we are discussing this with our partners and looking at a variety of different concepts. I don't really want to go into those details in this public setting because, as you can imagine, it's all pretty sensitive. These get to the heart of politics for every one of these governments and for the Palestinians and the Israelis as well. But I think reality has a way of pushing even those who can't imagine a concept such as the PA returning to Gaza. Reality has a way of intruding, and I think, as the Secretary frequently says, you can't beat something without something as an alternative for Palestinians.
Let me just—I understand the sensitivity about discussing particular plans. Let me just share a skepticism with you. There are lots of smart people in the foreign policy consensus in this town who believe that there is going to be a Arab force, an Arab-funded force. I worry that that greatly misunderstands the risk tolerance of our Arab friends. That certainly, in your head or on paper, makes all sorts of sense for the Saudis and the Emiratis, others, to either populate or front a governance structure or a security force. They have never been willing to take a chance that big, and it probably overestimates how much they care about the future of the Palestinian people.
I would just say we're intimately acquainted with their thinking on all of this. And so I would say there is no magical thinking on the part of this administration. We're well aware of how tough a piece this is, because we have to remind ourselves this has been a piece of territory run, ruled, governed, if you will, at the point of a gun for 17 years by a foreign terrorist organization. That is not easy to deconstruct. And we've obviously made the point publicly and privately that you can't do it all by military means alone. There will have to be a political alternative, and that's what we're in the process of putting together, these concepts.
Ms. Pryor, just I'm at the end of questions, but just say a word about the consequences of another year of a prohibition on U.S. funding for UNRWA. Most all countries, almost without exception, that had temporarily turned off funding for UNRWA as the investigation was ongoing, have started that funding again. And I just don't understand how these fragile places like Jordan and Lebanon and Syria survive if UNRWA has only 2 months of funding at any given time without the United States playing a role and without, frankly, a lot of our Gulf allies stepping up and filling the vacuum.
Thank you for that question. USAID does not fund UNRWA. However, we are looking, especially in places like Jordan or Lebanon, in which you do have refugee populations dependent upon UNRWA, on how we can better use our own assistance to help mitigate that impact. In both Jordan and Lebanon, we do a lot of work with host communities, which also has the added benefit of helping refugee populations as well. So we will take a look and see what is it that we can do from our side, given that we don't fund UNRWA, to help soften the blow of the loss of our funding.
Right, but you are a partner, but you are partners with all sorts of organizations that do work with UNRWA. You are in the same business. You must have a view as to the seriousness about UNRWA working on a budget right now that doesn't have enough cash flow to last more than 60 days.
Yes, it is very concerning because this is not something we were able to budget for to be able to compensate for that.
You can't fill in. USAID cannot fill in for the gap that has been created.
It would be extremely difficult for us to do that with the resources that we have.
Thank you, Senator Young.
Assistant Secretary Leaf, you referenced this concept of the Palestinian Authority returning to Gaza, something some senior administration officials, including the President of the United States, is mentioning, discussing a revitalized Palestinian Authority. Assistant Secretary, what specific parameters will meet the threshold for a revitalized Palestinian Authority?
So the PA government, the new government that was established in April, has a reform agenda for its own and one that we are pressing them to implement. And that goes to accountability, transparency, rooting out corruption, enabling services to the public, basically the kind of thing, bread and butter things that any government owes its people and also owes its donors. The problems it's facing right now is a severe financial crisis. That is one that has been in part the product of October 7th and the closure of the West Bank in large part to traffic to and a shrinking of the economy. It's also the withholding of clearance revenues by the Israeli government at this point. The reform it needs to undertake is to make it fit and proper for governance where it is now, let alone the ability to govern a larger portion of public.
Right. So if you could briefly speak to what specific actions are needed to meet the criteria of a reform PAs, political and financial reforms, would it be a total abolition, I would hope, of pay-for-slave programs? What else?
Yes, that's exactly right. It's a mix of administrative reforms that go to the issue of accountability of the money that it has and where it's going and how it's being spent. But you're right, prisoner payment, pay for slay, that is a key piece of a discussion that we have been having for some time. And I think we're very near a conclusion to that.
What steps, if any, do we know that regional partners may be willing to take in furtherance of this reform PA?
All of them want to see the same thing. All of them recognize the declining legitimacy and credibility of that governing structure in the West Bank. They all to every one of them want to see the PA assume its responsibilities in Gaza, but they're very aware of the weaknesses of the organization.
Okay. Moving to Hamas, they confirmed Secretary Blinken confirmed last week that Hamas rejected the most recent ceasefire and hostage exchange proposal. So trying to get a sense of where that leaves us. What steps is the U.S. prepared to take to increase pressure on Hamas and, if necessary, its external enablers?
So I think what you heard the Secretary say was something short of reject. It was a yes, but with a lot of buts to it, the response that we saw on Tuesday night when we were out in the region. So some of those changes to the text were things that you could manage. Others were less apparently so. And we're in intensive discussions right now with the mediators and Israel about the way forward. We do believe ultimately this proposal is the best roadway to get an end to the conflict now that would enable a multitude of things and that would ultimately be offer the prospect for an end to the conflict altogether, ensuring Israel's security, of course, and ensuring the security, frankly, of the people who have of Gaza who have labored under this terrible regime.
Lastly, Assistant Secretary Leaf, I'm asking you, when the U.S. withholds arms from Israel or seeks to enact arbitrary red lines on Israel, how does this not embolden Hamas and lead to them thinking they can outlast the war without releasing hostages?
Senator, let me be really clear on this point. There's
Please.
Exactly one case that the president asked us to hit pause on. There is no larger pause or cessation of security assistance to Israel. And the president, the secretary, have been absolutely clear.
He's taking that off the table.
Sorry?
He's taking that off the table.
There's one case. There's one case right now. And that
and
went
he's taking
direct
it off the table?
I'm sorry?
He's taking that prospect off the table.
Of that case? No. I mean, it's under review, but it is only one
Just,
case.
Prospectively, then I'll ask you, if the U.S. were to withhold arms from Israel, how would that not embolden Hamas and lead them to them thinking, finish the question? Yep.
So, Senator, I don't want to deal in a hypothetical, but what this president has been clear about is we absolutely have Israel's back.
Thank you.
Senator Kane.
Thank you to the chair and ranking member, and thank you to our witnesses for being here. I'm going to continue on Israel. Gaza, Israel has a right to defend itself, and the U.S. needs to be a partner with Israel in defending itself against those who would annihilate it. Hamas, Iranian-backed militias, Hezbollah, Houthis, Iran itself. I celebrated on April 14 when the U.S. helped Israel, together with other nations, knock down drones and missiles fired from Iran into Israel. Palestinians have a right to live. Palestinians have a right to live and not to be collectively treated as if they're part of a terrorist group when they're not. Most in Gaza are not Hamas. The vast majority in the West Bank are not Hamas. And while I support the U.S. effort to give Israel tools to defend itself against those who had annihilated, I have been disappointed and expressed it publicly that the Israeli effort to support humanitarian aid to civilians, Israeli discussion about a future for Palestine, the slow pace of allowance of aid, the commission of violence against Palestinians on the West Bank, in some instances escorted by IDF reservists and border patrol officials, make this look to many that it is not just a defense against Hamas, but that it is a larger effort to target Palestinians. The administration, at Senator Van Hollen's request, and others of us joined in that request, in February announced a new policy, National Security Memorandum 20, that required recipients of U.S. military aid to meet two criteria. First, that the military aid would be used in accord with international law, and second, those receiving military aid, any nation receiving military aid, had to cooperate with U.S.-supported humanitarian efforts. The administration certified that Israel was meeting both of those pillars of NSM 20. The first pillar about whether military aid is being used in accord with international law is a murky one because of the way Hamas embeds in civilian populations, but I'll be blunt. I don't think the second pillar regarding humanitarian aid is that murky. And this is what I want to engage with you on. If Israel was engaged in sufficient effort to provide humanitarian aid, the U.S. wouldn't have to be building a jerry-rigged pier off the coast of Gaza, deploying Virginians from Fort Houston elsewhere to do it. You would see a higher pace of humanitarian aid being delivered through border crossings in Israel into Gaza. You would not see Cindy McCain, the widow of a former Senate Foreign Relations Committee member, executive director of the World Food Program, saying that there's, quote, full-blown famine in northern Gaza. I don't think you'd see USAID Administrator Power publicly stating that it's credible to assess that there is famine in Gaza. The news since Sunday has been that the Israeli Defense Forces want to do a strategic pause in some military operations in Gaza every day to allow humanitarian aid to get to more Palestinians, and they are being attacked by Prime Minister Netanyahu and members of the cabinet for their effort to do some pauses in Gaza to allow humanitarian aid. So, As the leader of our State Department and USAID in this remit, how can we conclude that there is sufficient humanitarian aid being allowed by Israel into Gaza on this set of facts?
Senator, thank you for that set of comments and questions. I wouldn't say there is sufficient humanitarian aid going into Gaza by no stretch of the imagination. But it is not because Israel is trying to impede it. There are a whole set of complex factors at work, among which is the extremely poor security conditions, for instance, on the other side of Kerem Shalom. I was on a long discussion, a phone call this morning with our embassy in Jerusalem, as well as our special envoy, Lise Grande, and she and we are working assiduously to help untangle some of the issues, and some of them are quite difficult to get at, because as the IDF has stepped back, various violent actors have stepped in to the point that even the much-diminished Hamas enforcers cannot get control of independent families and gangs and so forth. So that is a huge piece of what is going on right now. The risk factors for humanitarian workers are at the very uppermost levels of intolerability for the UN and other NGOs. But we're working across the board on these issues with the Israeli government, with the IDF, with COGAT, and they are doing these pauses. There's obviously a lot of politics at play around many issues related to Gaza, but the fact is we are getting partnership and cooperation. It's just a fraught situation.
I'm over my time, and I don't want to belabor the point, but I don't want us to lose credibility. You know, we can't control the activities of other nations, but we can control our own. And when we render a conclusion that Israel is sufficiently cooperating with the United States on the delivery of humanitarian aid, at the same time as we're having to spend hundreds of million dollars on a star-crossed effort to build an unworkable pier to get humanitarian aid into Gaza. And if we render a conclusion that Israeli actions are sufficient when the Israeli government is engaged in a significant war of words against their own IDF trying to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza, I worry it makes us look like that we lose our own credibility by blessing an effort that is thus far entirely insufficient. I yield back.
Senator Van Hollen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank both of you for your testimony and service. I want to begin with a question about an Egyptian man, Mahmoud Hussein, who was arbitrarily detained for wearing an anti-torture T-shirt in 2014. He was released after 2 years on arbitrary pretrial detention, but then rearrested in April 2023. He's now free on bail. We're pursuing this case because he has family in Baltimore and also because he's been unjustly detained. My question, Madam Assistant Secretary, is a very simple one on this. Number one, are you familiar with the case? But number two, when do we expect the Egyptian parliament to finally pass the proposed legislation to change the arbitrary detention rules? I'm just looking for a straight factual answer here.
I'm generally familiar with his case, but not in the details that you've just cited. To the second question, I can't give you an answer, but I will be happy to come back with that answer.
If you could, yeah, we've been in touch with Egyptian authorities, and this is something they keep saying is going to happen, but it never seems to actually happen. I'm just going to read a post from on the humanitarian situation in Gaza. I may come back to it, but I don't think anybody can question the credibility of UNICEF's global spokesman, James Elder. This was a post he put up just a few days ago when things have allegedly improved. This was my Wednesday in Gaza. 13-hour mission to go just 40 kilometers. 8 hours held at checkpoints. Despite approvals, our truck carrying UNICEF medicines and nutrition supplies for 10,000 children got turned back. He adds to that note, and two fishermen seeking food for their families shot dead on the beach in front of us. So, Madam Assistant Secretary, I don't think that the humanitarian situation in Gaza has gotten better. We saw more goods coming in from the Erez crossing, and it was improving slightly, but then, of course, the Rafah operation shut off anything coming across the Rafah crossing. And Kerem Shalom, you can cross from Kerem Shalom into Gaza, but if you can't actually get to the people who need the help, obviously that doesn't achieve the goal. I want to associate myself with the comments of my friend, Senator Kaine, both in terms of Israel's clear right, in fact, I would argue duty, to defend itself, but also the importance of the conduct of the war. The president's talked about this. But I want to turn to the West Bank for a moment, because the West Bank is growing more unstable by the day. You've had over 122 children die, killed in the West Bank since October 7th alone. And there are lots of people who are responsible for overseeing the West Bank. But one of them, as you know, is Finance Minister Smotrich, who also has an important portfolio within the Ministry of Defense over civil affairs in the West Bank. And there are numerous reports indicating that he's used his position to assist extremist settlers, including many who have been sanctioned under the administration's EO, and I commend the administration for its EO, In addition, as reported in a New York Times Magazine piece with longtime investigative reporters, IDF officials have said that Smotrich has undermined efforts to limit construction of settlements illegal under Israeli law, quote, to the point where it has disappeared, unquote. He then boasted about this, he, Smotrich, saying, we will do everything to prevent a Palestinian state that will endanger our existence here. I'm proud to fight and prevent the Arab takeover of territories and help legitimize the Jewish heroes who settle the West Bank, unquote. And I don't know if you were with Secretary Blinken back in March, but at that time, Smotrich announced the largest single seizure of Palestinian lands in one day. He also has been talked about, has been withholding funds. You, the Secretary, the President have talked about this. You would agree that these are all destabilizing to the West Bank, would you not?
Yes.
And so my question is this. The EO is very clear. What the EO says is that any individuals or entities who have engaged in actions, including directing, enacting, implementing, enforcing, or failing to enforce policies that threaten the peace, security, or stability of the West Bank, are subject to this set of sanctions under the EO. Why has the administration not sanctioned Smotrich, given the clear violations of the terms of the president's executive order?
Senator, if I can quickly turn back to the the humanitarian situation in Gaza, I want to be clear about one point. I'm not suggesting that it has improved. We were beginning to see an improvement, a gentle trend upwards in April. That was reversed with the Rafah operation, and so we are working against that. On the West Bank, you're absolutely right that there are a whole constellation of factors and actors that are taking things to a very precarious position. And I would agree with you on all of those points, that those are relevant to that picture. You can appreciate that we don't discuss publicly who we put on our list for consideration. It is an ongoing process.
I thank you. And just in closing, Mr. Chairman, again, I would really urge the administration to take this action and take it immediately, because the situation is getting worse, not better. And Smotrich continues to threaten more illegal outposts and withholding or some combination of those. So if we want to send a signal that we're serious, it cannot just be sanctioning some extremist settlers and some settler farms. It has to get to the root of the issue, and this is one of those roots. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Van Hollen. Senator Hagerty.
Thank you. Deputy Assistant Administrator Pryor, I'm going to start with you. When Secretary Blinken appeared before the Appropriations Committee in October of last year, I asked him a very simple question, and that was whether he could guarantee that no U.S. taxpayer funding had been, this included in aid to Gaza, had been used to fund or support the Hamas attacks on October the 7th of 2023. I asked him repeatedly, and repeatedly he declined to make that guarantee. That week, I also sent a letter both to Secretary Blinken and USAID Administrator Pryor asking how much in U.S. taxpayer-funded foreign assistance has been sent specifically to Gaza, and to list each recipient in Gaza, whether at the awardee level or the sub-awardee level. I have that letter right here. That was months ago. 8 months later, USAID has failed to give me a complete answer. In particular, the agency has refused to disclose recipients at the sub-awardee level. The responses that I've received from AID have made it clear that the agency has the information about sub-awardees, that it's not classified, but the agency is not providing it. So, Ms. Pryor, why, 8 months later, after I sent a letter with a very simple request, has the administration refused to provide the U.S. Senate with basic transparency about who's receiving U.S. taxpayer dollars, especially at the sub-awardee level, so we can see where it's being spent?
Thank you for your question, sir. The safety of our implementing partner staff is our utmost paramount concern. And this is such a high-risk environment where Hamas can target our implementing partner staff. I'm not familiar with this. I believe this is on the humanitarian assistance side, so I'm happy to go back to my colleagues On humanitarian assistance and see what is the status of this response and how we get you the information you are seeking.
I certainly want the information, deserve the information. It's been 8 months. I think I know why you're hesitating. Like I raised this with Administrator Power. I shared with her one of the subawardees that's doing just what we're concerned about. I think that's the reason you're not sharing this information is because this sort of activity, Hamas-supporting activity, is occurring among the subawardees. You're all going to be back in front of us on the Appropriations Committee where I sit next month. I expect to have this information before then.
Noted, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. Assistant Secretary Leaf, I'd like to turn to you now. The Biden administration has declined to unilaterally recognize a Palestinian state and has stated that a Palestinian state should be established through, quote, direct negotiations between the parties involved in the conflict. Will this remain the administration's position through January 20th of 2025?
Yes, Senator, absolutely. That's longstanding policy, and it's been the president's own approach to this issue set throughout his career.
Well, I'm pleased to hear you say that unequivocally, because here's the reason for my concern. Back in December of 2016, in the lame duck Obama administration, we saw the Obama administration betray Israel and allow the infamously anti-Israel UN Security Council Resolution number 2334 to go into effect. And as I fast forward to today, the Biden administration has been pushing Israel to agree to a normalization agreement with Saudi Arabia. And that agreement would require Israel to agree to, quote, a credible pathway to a Palestinian state. And my concern would be that if Israel were to agree to this, quote, credible pathway, that the Biden administration might turn around and do just as the Obama administration did back in 2016 and unilaterally recognize a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital, while falsely claiming that this is what Israel had already agreed to. So I just want to be clear again. Is there any scenario between now and January 20th where the Biden administration would recognize a Palestinian state in the absence of Israel's official recognition of a Palestinian state?
That would be the subject of direct negotiations, sir. Direct negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians.
And only then. There would be no recognition absent
that. That's
right.
That.
I just want to make sure, make clear.
Yes.
Thanks very much. Thanks for putting that on the record for me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. And Senator Hagerty, I'd be glad to work with you on that request you made for information. There may be some reasons why it should be done in a classified setting, but be happy to work with you on that. Be happy to work with you on that. We'll open it to a second round of questions here, at the very least from myself and the ranking member. Ambassador Leaf, Qatar has come under a lot of scrutiny for good reason since October 7th. But I misunderstand a lot of the animosity. Yes, they host Hamas, but my understanding is that that has been at our request. Yes, they have relations with the Taliban, but that has accrued to the benefit of the United States, utilized by Democratic and Republican administrations. They have previously been the conduit that flows funds into Gaza, done at the request of the Israeli government. So just speak for a moment about how the status of the U.S.-Qatar relationship right now and what the world would look like if we didn't have Qatar's ability to allow us to speak to our adversaries in the region.
Thank you, Senator, for that really important question. And having gone to Israel, I think, 9 times since October 7th, and actually my first 2 years in office, I did a lot of work with the Israelis on especially the Israeli security establishment. And I would say that there has been, even before October 7th, there were very mixed feelings about the logic of using Qatar as a conduit for funds. But after October 7th, of course, there has been the terribly traumatic, the trauma that endures as long as hostages are kept by Hamas and other actors in Gaza. So there has been frustration from the same folks who understand that Qatar is a really critical channel, just as you say, alongside Egypt, but it has just gifts that it brings and influence it brings to bear on this. I would just say the following. Qatar really, to use that somewhat tired expression, really does punch above its weight. And it has a nimbleness of approach with a variety of actors that we don't have relations with, but that we need to communicate with, and regimes as well as non-state actors. And they have worked tirelessly on this hostage piece. There has been very understandable frustration from the families, from the Israeli government. Can't Qatar do more? Can't the U.S., put more pressure on Qatar to put more pressure on Hamas? And I would just say, as I did a few weeks ago before HVAC, you know, there's the cadre of political officials of Hamas in Doha, and boy, do they squeeze them. I can assure you they squeeze them. But at the end of the day, there's one guy 10 stories below the ground, a psychopath, messianic in his own belief that he has established himself in history, and there's sort of a sunk cost to having lost thousands of fighters and caused carnage in Gaza. So Qatar's ability to do the indirect mediation is critical to our interests and to Israel's. But I would say they have become a very trusted partner of ours.
Yeah, there are other allies of the United States that have relations with Hamas. Qatar's the only one that seems to be willing to do the hardest work of convening these conversations.
Yes. So
an imperfect ally.
Yes.
And a human rights record that needs to get better. But appreciate your comments. Let me ask you one bigger picture question. We, you know, have the outlines of a very important potential agreement in Lebanon, mm-hmm. to be able to move Hezbollah back off the border and maybe even get in a conversation about border demarcation. We have a political standstill in Yemen with the added complication of Houthi provocations into the Red Sea. Both seem static until the Gaza conflict comes to a close. I just think it's important for this committee to understand that the end of the conflict in Gaza is important to be able to ultimately bring about a long-term security settlement with respect to Hamas's ability to hit Israel ever again. But it is also right now standing in the way of moving forward on a Yemen political process, on a de-escalation with the Houthis, and a potential breakthrough in Lebanon. Am I right about that?
You are absolutely right about all of that. And, you know, the diplomacy continues even while we are working to get to that ceasefire agreement. So Amos Hochstein is out in the region. He's been out there for several days, essentially working to calm things down. Things are quite volatile, alarmingly so. And we heard that in stereophonic sound last week on our trip through the region. So he is doing his work even ahead of a formal pause. Tim Lenderking is doing his work relentlessly, both in terms of the work with our partners on Red Sea security, but importantly on the piece to get regional partners to really lean in hard on the Houthi. So all of this continues at pace, but you're right, the Gaza ceasefire will be the break point where we can do something really important in both directions.
Let me sneak in one last question on Egypt. The State Department waived certification requirements tied to human rights improvements on the $235 million of Egypt's FY 2022 FMF. But upon becoming chair of the full committee, Senator Cardin put a hold on that funding. My impression is that since the chairman's hold has been in place, the Egyptian government has really failed to engage in any meaningful cooperation with the United States on any of our core interests, and that we have further not seen any real progress with respect to the pre-trial detention reforms or the release of significant numbers of political prisoners. Feels like just like the amount of funding to Egypt has been stuck in place since the mid-80s, progress with Egypt has been stuck at least for the past 6 months.
The one thing I would say that is really, really important in this picture is the final resolution wrapping up entirely of case 173. And, you know, the dismissal of charges, the release of freezes and detentions and so forth. So this is a really significant step forward for all of the people and the organizations that were caught up in that years-long case. I asked just a couple of days ago for a status report on the pretrial detention legislation, and I plan to go back to our post and see where we stand with that. You know, the discussions that we had, as I recall dimly, crested in September. And of course, we had the events of October 7th, which have really, I would unfortunately have thoroughly preoccupied our government, Egypt's government. They've been preoccupied both with the conflict right across their border with Sudan. But I assure you, we have not lost sight of that. And I will come back to you with some more comments on that.
All right, great. Thank you. Senator Young.
Secretary, two questions, two lines of questioning. One, I'm going to touch on drones and then subsea cables, so you know where I'm headed with this. So Iran's drone production, a lot has been said and written about that, but recent reports, they're based on an analysis of some downed Iranian drones, found multiple components originating from U.S. manufacturers, microchips, circuit boards, GPS modules, some other components. I understand it's nearly impossible to completely cut off Iran from attaining these parts, but what, if anything, are we doing to try and interrupt some of these flows?
It's a really critical issue because, of course, the drones are a threat throughout the region, and now they are fully in the battlefield in Ukraine. So we have designated dozens of entities involved in the UAV program, and we have imposed comprehensive export controls to try to restrict Iran's access to key technologies insofar as possible. And we are enlisting the help of our European and other partners in this effort. It's, as you say, exceptionally difficult to get at everything because some of these things are just off-the-shelf kind of components which can be used for a multiplicity of things.
Do you have sufficient personnel? I know this has been an issue over at Commerce with respect to the monitoring of our export controls on microprocessors, and we're looking at so many different fronts right now and so many different technologies of a dual-use nature, that might be something to look into if you don't have that information at the ready.
I'd be happy to look into that.
There are a number of members of this committee that would like to be helpful. Thank you. So with respect to subsea cables, what diplomatic efforts are underway to get some of the subsea cables like those in the Red Sea that have been directly or indirectly damaged by Houthis, underway to get these cables repaired?
I don't have an answer for you on that, but I will be happy to take that back.
Well, I believe that we need to be monitoring this situation very closely. 95% of the world's internet traffic occurs through subsea cables. These are strategic assets, obviously, critical to our commerce, and every bit as important as the above water goods and services that traffic every day, and we take great care to secure. So, yes, kindly report back to me on any activities underway to restore service there. And then as the leader of a regional bureau at the department, what, if any, additional authorities or resources would you or your counterparts in other bureaus need to prioritize security of undersea cables within your areas of responsibility? There again, if you need to report back. I'd certainly welcome that. Do you have any initial thoughts that you'd like to?
I don't, sir. But I will be happy to take that one back as well. So additional authorities. Yeah.
Okay. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Young. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ambassador Leaf, you are the administration's point person on the Middle East. How's that working out?
I love my job, Senator.
Have things in the Middle East gotten better or worse since Joe Biden became president?
We have had a series of black swan events, so no doubt the region is in a very difficult state.
Is your answer things have gotten worse?
My answer is that a series of black swan events have crowded upon the—
Have they gotten better? You're not suggesting things have gotten better,
no,
are you?
No, I have not.
In fact, they've gotten a lot worse.
That's the nature of black swan.
So it's black swans. You guys had nothing to do with it. It's not mistakes you made. It's just something that happened externally.
Well, I think an assessment of the events of October 7th is still to be done. I can't speak to that.
Okay, so did y'all make any mistakes that led to it?
I'm not sure.
All right, here's one. How about giving hundreds of millions of dollars to the Gaza Strip, much of which ended up in the hands of Hamas? Was that a mistake now that we saw what happened on October 7th?
I'm going to defer to my colleague from USAID. I'm not aware of hundreds of millions of dollars going to Hamas from U.S. coffers.
All right, how about $100 billion to Iran? Was that a mistake?
I'm not sure what you're referring to, Senator.
You tell me. How much money has this administration flowed to Iran?
We have not flowed money to Iran.
Really?
We have money in accounts that are restricted for humanitarian use only.
And money's not fungible?
This regime will always spend money on these kinds of activities, the proxy activities.
When Joe Biden became president, how much was Iran selling in oil a day?
I don't have that figure for you, Senator.
Of course you don't. The answer is about 300,000 barrels a day. How much is Iran selling in oil a day now?
Somewhere short of 2 million.
So it went from 300,000 barrels a day to 2 million barrels a day. That's about $80 billion that the Ayatollah has made because your administration refuses to enforce oil sanctions.
No, we do enforce oil sanctions.
Well, you do so terribly because the number has increased almost tenfold.
But because of the strictures that we put on, the sanctions that we put on, the targeting that we've done, 230 alone directed towards those who traffic in Iranian oil, that has imposed a heavy cost on Iran, and we estimate that
You're saying it's a heavy cost. Mm-hmm. They went from 300,000 barrels a day to 2 million barrels a day. Where's the heavy cost? That's an extra 1.7 million barrels a day. That's $80 billion. True or false, 90% of Hamas's funding comes from Iran?
No, not 90%. It is a large substantial.
Okay, how much is it
amount.
Then?
I don't know at this
moment.
Of this
course,
exact,
you're in charge of the damn region, and you don't.
This,
what do you mean you don't
at
know?
At this exact moment, I can't tell you.
All right, how much of Hezbollah's funding comes from Iran?
Huge, huge amount.
It's about 90%. Both of those are about 90%. Do you think it made the world safer or less safe to take a theocratic lunatic like the Ayatollah who chants death to America and death to Israel and to flow $100 billion? Did that make us more safe or less safe?
The U.S. is not flowing money to Iran, Senator.
What about the $6 billion in hostage payments?
Not a penny has moved.
And money's not fungible? They
not
can't put that up
moved.
For credit facilities?
Not a penny has moved.
You're where? You're under oath.
I am.
And could they put that money up for credit facilities to use money to fund their terror activity?
I'm not sure who would be in the position of lending the money at this point. Senator, we do have plenty of sanctions. Iran is one of the most heavily sanctioned regimes.
But you're not enforcing them. This administration, every lunatic on earth that wants to kill us, this administration gives money to. All right, let me ask you this. Israel has said it is their policy to utterly eliminate Hamas. Does this administration, does President Biden support Israel in its commitment to utterly eliminate Hamas?
Of course.
Of course? Then why are you calling for an immediate ceasefire before they eliminate Hamas?
Israel has accepted that proposal.
No, they have not.
They have.
Is there a ceasefire that's happened?
Hamas is not yet fully accepted.
Is there a ceasefire? Israel most certainly has not. I'm aware the Biden administration has told the press that Israel has.
The Israeli leadership.
So I asked you a question. Do Do you support Israel's military objective of utterly eliminating Hamas? You said yes, and the next sentence you said, but they should cease fire right now and not eliminate Hamas.
No, I agree with the way that the president characterized it, Senator, on May 31st, which is to say that we agree with the objective that that Hamas never again control the Gaza Strip or threaten Israel. That will not be achieved by military means alone.
So it's not a, no, we said their military objective was to defeat Hamas. So you just said it's impossible to defeat Hamas.
When you
Is that
first
right?
posed the question, you said eliminate Hamas.
Over I said time, utterly eliminate Hamas. I didn't say over time, not over a thousand
no,
years. I said defeat an enemy because they are murderers who murdered 1,200 people who raped women and little girls.
It won't be done by military means alone.
Okay, so it is the position of this administration is impossible by military means to defeat Hamas.
Yes, it is.
Let me ask you, you also want to see, essentially as a reward for October 7th, a Palestinian state.
It's not a reward.
It's not a reward. It just achieves what they want as a
Hamas,
benefit for these murders.
Hamas.
Let me ask you something. If Hamas is governed by Hamas, if Hamas governs Gaza, how is Israel's safety protected? Impressive job, Mr. Chairman. Bang, bang.
Let the witness finish answering the question.
You should not be frightened of these questions, Mr. Chairman.
Gentlemen's time has expired.
Hamas has never supported a two-state solution. So, indeed, a Palestinian state that is negotiated with Israel, that lives in peace side by side
and
with
governed
Israel,
by Hamas.
Is not a reward to Hamas. Hamas doesn't support such a thing, does not recognize Israel's right to exist.
Your policy has been an utter disaster.
Thank you very much to both of our witnesses for being here today. What we're going to do is keep the record open until 5 p.m. on Thursday, and we'll appreciate any answers to questions that come in before then. With that, this subcommittee is adjourned.